I'd like to reflect for a few minutes on our second reading, which is St. Paul's letter to the Galatians from chapter 5. And Paul is talking here about loving our neighbor as ourselves and how the flesh and the spirit are opposed to one another. Now, what's this all about? There's an old Christian heresy which basically says that our bodies are bad. The body is basically a prison for the soul, and that we are to resist physical desires, even extinguish them if possible. That's the heresy. But what does the church actually teach? The Catholic Church, in following especially the creation account in the book of Genesis, insists that the material world, and especially human beings in this world, are masterpieces of God's loving creativity. Now, our human body is integral to who we are as human beings. We are, in essence, enfleshed spirits. Jesus did not come only to save souls. Jesus came to save human beings. And in his life here on earth, he fed the bodies of the hungry. He healed the bodies of the sick. He even forgave their sins, taught them spiritual truths. And in fact, we of course believe not only in the immortality of the soul, but amazingly, we believe in the resurrection of the body. So the desires of the body, the natural desires for food, for drink, for sleep, and also for sexual union, all of these are fundamentally good. They are not bad. And Pope John Paul did such wonderful work during his lifetime in teaching us how that is so. So if that's true, what does Paul mean when he says that the spirit and the flesh are directly opposed? Well, when Paul speaks about the flesh, the word we've translated into English, he's not really talking about the human body, but rather he's using flesh as a code word for the distortion that original sin has introduced into our human nature. The flesh, this distortion, misdirects natural desires to make them destructive and ultimately degrading, to actually make us less human than God intends us to be. Lust is a good example. And lust is not the same as sexual desire. Lust is what the flesh does to sexual desire, essentially distorting it in various ways, and even in some cases making it an instrument of exploitation rather than committed love and directed to the miracle of new life, which is God's intention for sexual desire. Now, pride is what the flesh does to this natural drive, causing it to refuse submission to legitimate authority. And we're talking about particularly the authority of God, exalting itself at the expense of others and seeking to dominate and to belittle others. Now, before the coming of the Spirit, in other words, we're talking about Old Testament times, the flesh, we can say, tyrannized human beings from within. The law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, obviously insists that we should not act on our distorted desires. But you and I know that our willpower is often rather weak. And on its own, our willpower alone cannot win these battles, cannot keep things on track. Left only to our willpower, we are bound to lose in this struggle. I think for a couple Sundays in a row, I've been talking about King David, or mentioned King David, one of the very greatest, if not the greatest, of Israel's king. And remember what happened to him. He yielded to lust, and then he covered up this adultery with murder. And he repented and he was forgiven. But with Jesus Christ, God's solution to all this is quite radical. And when you and I are joined to Jesus Christ through faith and baptism, we have the possibility of being totally filled with the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit, in any event, begins the healing of our wounded human nature from within. And ultimately, the goal of the Holy Spirit is to transform every aspect of our lives. Now, this is an ongoing process, and you and I know that sometimes we're going forward, or nothing's happening, or as the Protestants say, we become backsliders. So it's a process, but the Holy Spirit can do this to us and for us. The word virtue, in fact, means power or strength, and the Spirit brings with him virtues that empower us to triumph over these struggles against the flesh. The flesh is still there, even after we have been cleansed by baptism, but we can say its back is broken. It can no longer tyrannize us unless we choose to let that be the case. And Paul says in his letter, the passage we just read, we now have the freedom and power, the power from the Holy Spirit, to ignore the tugs of the flesh towards sin. And hopefully, as we progress in the Christian life, these tendencies towards sin, you might say, will become weaker and weaker as we hopefully grow in virtue and holiness. Now, charity is the virtue given to us by the Spirit, which enables us, empowers us to sanctify sexual desires by making it an instrument of love in life as God intended. Humility is the virtue that enables the drive for greatness to respect the sovereignty of God and the dignity of our human beings. And I want to underline all these things. The need for us to have humility, the need for us to have charity. And in Paul, in this same passage, reminds us, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Because I'm going further with this. These are requirements imposed on us. In any event, the Christian life is certainly not about being a slave to some rules and to repressing our natural human desires. The Christian life, as you've heard me say in citing Pope Benedict, the Christian life is about turning our hearts over to Jesus Christ. And it's about empowerment in the Holy Spirit to become truly great, truly human, actually, hopefully, you become very holy, or nearing that goal anyway, and truly free, so we are not enslaved by the flesh. So that's the danger that in that area that everybody can fall into. Now, these words about how we each need, each one need healing in our human nature, and how you and I each need the strength and the power of the Holy Spirit in our own lives to live out the virtues of charity and humility, this is the context in which I'd like to say a few words about the tragic U.S. Supreme Court decisions this past week, which further undermine our understanding of marriage as between one man and one woman. You know, we Catholics, when we look at what is reality, what is truth, we have two sources to tell us what truth is. We have everything we can learn by our minds, every reason, everything we can learn from science, everything we can learn from talking to people, observing reality. We love reason. We love science, everything that we can find out. And we also have another channel of divine revelation, which sometimes we refer to as faith. And if we're talking about the reality of anything, these two always have to coincide. And if our own hearts, they don't seem to coincide, maybe our faith isn't quite what it should be, or reality, maybe we've misdiagnosed what reality is. But there is no conflict between the two. So we benefit from these two channels. And in the area of marriage between one man and one woman, the two perfectly coincide. And having said that faith and reason perfectly coincide, we can say that in the public square, when we're talking to people outside of the church, we do not need to hit people over the head with our Bible or even hit them over the head with our catechism, although these are essential for us. In order, in the secular world, to continue to rationally defend marriage between one man and one woman on three counts. I don't want to go into the details of this now, but here are the three elements which, when you're talking to people who don't know anything about the Bible, don't know anything about catechism, this should be truth for them if they will encounter this. First reason, we are interested in the welfare of children. So what we are claiming is that on a rational basis, it can be shown that a loving mother, a loving husband, is the best situation for children. I think almost everybody knows that, but the studies are all clear. So we're talking about the good of the children. Two, we make the claim on a rational basis that traditional marriage between one man and one woman is good for our civil society. We know it's good for the parish. We know that a loving mother, loving wife, loving mother who has children, this family is the cell of the parish. That's good for the whole parish when you have that situation. And third, most of us believe that limited government is beneficial, even arguably essential, for our common good and for the defense of religious freedom. So we can also make the case, I won't make it here, that marriage between one man and one woman, a loving relationship, the children, this makes possible, one can say, a more limited government than would be the case otherwise. We want limited government so that we can become as human as God intends us to be without the government preventing us from becoming so human. Now, what is at stake is the survival of marriage itself. Now, you may think this is an exaggeration. This matter has actually very little to do, the current struggle for gay marriage actually has very little to do with adult romance. As it is being more and more publicly admitted, and I've put in the back of the church some copies of an article on this, actually I think I posted it on the bulletin board, as is publicly admitted by same-sex advocates, the true purpose of this battle is actually to destroy marriage, to render totally meaningless traditional marriage as we have experienced it in Western civilization. And here's the quote that I posted on the bulletin board in back from a journalist, a same-sex marriage advocate. She said this in a recent radio interview. Quote, "It's a no-brainer that same-sex advocates should have the right to marry and that the institution of marriage should not exist. I do not think it should exist." Okay, that's their position, and that's why they're trying to destroy it. Brothers and sisters, we are nearing the end of the fortnight of freedom, proclaimed by our bishops as a time of prayer and intercession for our nation. You and I are being called upon to fulfill our responsibilities as Catholic patriots who love our country in calling America back to God. Before same-sex anything was an issue, our society was already busy dismantling its own foundations by innovations like no-fault divorce, which I think got going in the 1970s, but by 1,000 daily decisions to dishonor the norms of marriage that make it apt for family life. Very little now seems to separate an understanding of marriage from random non-marital bonds and romances. Part of rebuilding marriage and rebuilding our culture, which is in a state of collapse, we all know this, involves disciples of Jesus Christ reaching out to friends and neighbors suffering broken hearts or broken homes or loneliness or from whatever is the cause of their separation and isolation. Defending marriage depends in part, yes, it does depend on the outcome of particular legal battles. The legal battles will continue even after these Supreme Court decisions. It depends on our politics in part. Majority of the people voted into the presidency a man who is allied with the abortion industry and the pornography industry. If you know somebody who voted for this man, ask them what was going on in their mind that they allied their vote with the pornography industry and the abortion industry. What is their intention for their children and grandchildren to have somebody like this in control of the U.S. government? And I know there are parishioners who allied themselves with the pornography industry and the abortion industry. I don't know what's going on in their mind. This is at a common sense level. So it's part legal. Yes, it's politics. It would be easier to defend against this if we didn't have this type of people in control of the government. But most especially, it depends on turning around and rebuilding our culture. And this is something which we are responsible for. Nonetheless, it would seem that without divine intervention, we are heading for very hard times. And as discouraged as we might sometimes be, this is not the time for us to give up. It's the time to stand up and to pray. Our first prayer has to be for us and for our church, that God will awaken us to the extent we're a little sleepy, and others who need to join in this season of prayerful intercession. We need to pray for the grace and strengthening of the Holy Spirit to enliven all of us together into action. At World Youth Day in the year 2000 in Rome, Pope John Paul II looked out on more than 1 million young people who were present for this event, and he said to them, "It is Jesus who stirs in you the desire to do something great with your lives, the will to follow an ideal, the refusal to allow yourselves to be ground down by mediocrity, the courage to commit yourselves humbly and patiently to improving yourselves and society, making the world more human and more fraternal." Now, these are all qualities that we Catholics and all Americans need today. Lastly, and this is a challenge for me, we need not give up on our political leaders. No matter what evil is unfolding, no matter what evil is planned in the days ahead, we must even pray for what, from a human perspective, seems totally impossible. We must pray for their conversion. You know this famous quote, and it's almost a cliche, but it's true. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. Brothers and sisters, now is not the time to do nothing. Let us stand up as Catholic patriots, as disciples of Jesus Christ, and pray that the healing hand of the Lord be extended over this beloved land of ours.